Welcome to the Songs of Note podcast, where we talk about the songs we love and the stories behind them. I'm your host, Ryan Gregg.
I'm Ryan Gregg, and I'm so glad that you're here to hear the story behind one of rock's most infamous songs, one of the biggest songs in rock, and that is Derek and the Dominoes' song, Layla. There's so much that goes into this story. It is crazy between the Beatles, Eric Clapton, love, murder, the early death, crazy drug use. There's all kinds of stuff in here that you're like, oh my goodness, all those things were kind of connected to this one story and this one song. Well, after this interview, you can hear how. But I was really glad to get Jordan Runtag back on the show. He's a podcast host, executive producer at iHeartMedia. He does podcasts like Off the Record, Inside Studio, Rivals. He's a contributor to Rolling Stone, Entertainment Weekly, People, tons of stuff. Super, super interesting guy, and who has just very knowledgeable. He came on the episode for episode 24, where we talked about the Eagles song Hotel California, and which was one of my favorite episodes. And I think that this one probably takes the cake over Hotel California for me, as far as like, man, I didn't know some of this stuff. I knew a lot about it going in, but I feel like I learned a lot from Jordan in this interview. So you can follow him on Twitter, and I'll put the link to his Twitter in the show notes, so you can keep up with him. And be sure and follow Songs and Note on Instagram and Facebook, and come find me, and would love to interact with you so that we can keep learning about music and songs and bands, which is what we focus on in this podcast. And if you don't have the bonus episode for the podcast, you can get it by going to thesongsofnote.com, and you'll see a little pop-up that says, do you want a bonus episode? And if you sign up for my mailing list, you'll get a bonus episode of the show. So we'd love for you to check that out. And without further ado, this is Jordan Runtag and Layla by Derek and the Dominoes. Well, hey, Jordan, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show and talk about Layla today. I'm glad to have you.
Oh, man, Ryan, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, glad to have you back again. I know last time we talked, we were talking about Hotel California. And this time I was just trying to research what are some other songs that still have a lot of staying power, you know, that are classic rock songs that are still getting people talking. And I think you and I both love stories behind songs. And this one is a doozy. There's some really interesting stuff here. You got, there's love, there's murder, there's Beatles, there's all kinds of things that that can be hit on. But let's start with George Harrison and Eric Clapton. That's kind of where this whole thing generates. Can you talk a little bit about how did those guys, you know, meet in the first place? And we're talking mid 60s at this point, right?
Oh yeah. I mean, you can't talk about Layla without talking about how Eric met George. And they met in, I think it was in December of 1964, the Yardbirds were opening for the Beatles during one of their Christmas shows in London. And that was really the first time that Eric and George crossed paths. And George was, I think, literally watching Eric from the wings. I mean, Eric at this point was, you know, the hotshot blues guitarist on the scene in London. I mean, London in the mid-60s, huge hotbed of just British beat. I mean, you got bands like John Mayall's Blues Breakers that Eric would later join, and Alexis Corner. And of course, you've got the primitive Rolling Stones. I mean, it was just a hotbed for blues. And Eric was supreme. And so Eric was just kind of, or George rather, was just kind of checking him out, because George was a lot of things. He wasn't really a blues player. He's more of a rockabilly sort of Chet Atkins type picker. I mean, yeah, that's kind of what he fancied himself as, or like Chuck Berry. So they met there, and they became, it was sort of a mutual admiration society. They became friends soon after. And by the mid-60s, they kind of lived near each other. George got a bungalow in a place called Esher, which is like a suburb of London. And George got I feel like in mid-60s English rockers, you needed to have this like crazy house with a name. You know, Mick Jagger had Star Groves, and Keith Moon had Tara. Eric had, oh my gosh, what was the name of his... Do you remember the name of his house? It was like, it wasn't Henley Grange. That was
I forgot the
that
name.
That was Jimmy. Oh, I forget. But you know, so their big stately country piles were close to each other. So they would visit and talk about guitars. And of course, at this time, George was married to Patty Boyd, who he met on the set of the Beatles' first movie, A Hard Day's Night, and she was kind of the quintessential Maude model, like 60s swing in London, like somebody that I feel like the characters in Blow Up would be based on. I mean, she was just this, like, you know, really gorgeous, really talented, really sweet. I mean, she just was really just the most identifiable look of just swinging 60s London. They were such a power couple. And George would go over to, or Eric would go over to George's house, and Patty would be there, and they'd all talk and be friends, have dinner parties and stuff. And for a while, it was platonic. And he and George got closer, and they started collaborating on music. George wrote the White Album track Savoy Truffle in honor of Eric's sweet tooth. He was addicted to chocolate, like to the it was a brand called Good News Chocolates, and that song is just basically a list of all the different you know types of chocolates, and you'll have to have them all pulled out. Is referring to Eric Clapton's teeth. So he wrote that song as kind of a jab at his friend Eric. And of course, they collaborated on While My Guitar Gently Weeps. George invited him to play on lead guitar on that. And he also invited him to play on his first solo album, the soundtrack to 1968's Wonderwall, which is a weird, funky record if you've never heard it. It's pretty obscure. And then, of course, Oasis later borrowed the title Wonderwall very famously. And then George repaid the favor writing the Cream track Badge on Cream's final album, Goodbye. And he even played rhythm guitar on the song under the pseudonym, incredible pseudonym, L'Angelo Mysterioso.
That's a great one.
Right? Like, that's way better. Like, John Lennon always used Dr. Winston Oboogie, which is also very good, but L'Angelo Mysterioso is, like, such a killer name. But, yeah, I mean, it's really difficult to overstate how much these guys worked together. I mean, George was producing a lot of artists for the Beatles record label Apple Records, and he brought in Eric to play on all these artists that he produced, albums by Jackie Lomax, Billy Preston, Doris Troy. Eric was always there, and he was really sort of seen in the London music scene in the late 60s. This is around 1969 at this point, as kind of the heir apparent of George. And this is sort of never more apparent than when George stormed out of the Let It Be sessions in January of 1969. It just was too tense, and it just was really just pissed off by the whole thing, and he left. And John can be heard on some of the session tapes saying, okay, well, we'll give him a few days, and if he's not back, we'll just get Eric Clapton in.
Yeah, that's right. We'll just get Eric. Right. No big deal.
Right.
Oh, my gosh. And yeah.
It sounds like he's serious. I mean, he must have been, because a couple months later, when John played his first post-Beatles solo show at the Toronto Peace Festival, he got Clapton in to play.
That's right.
As part of the Plastic Ono Band, and
I remember that,
and the Rock and Roll Circus too, when John did that funny collaboration with Keith Richards, and I forget who was the drummer for that, but that they did Your Blues, under the name Dirty Mac, which was a great.
It's a weird little DVD or Blu-ray now that you can get that. Yeah, it's like the performances are really cool and also really strange, and it's a good little watch. Go ahead.
So by this point, it's the late 60s, and Clapton has really had an unimpeachable streak of just music throughout the 60s. I mean, you got the Yardbirds, you have John Mayall's Blues Breakers for the famous Beano album, which is, I mean, my favorite John Mayall album. Cream, of course, and Blind Faith. Around this time, there's graffiti popping up around London reading Clapton is God. And even if that's kind of a myth, which it kind of sounds like it might be, it still really speaks to his reputation. You don't get much bigger than Eric Clapton in the London music scene. He is God, but he's still not a Beatle. And I'm sure on some level that had to be galling for him. And I really think that on some level, even though he and George were so close, there was some sense of competition that began to creep in. And I guess what you could call envy. And I think that this is symbolized and embodied by George's stunningly beautiful and wonderful wife, Patty. And she even said as much in later years. She really thought that Eric's attraction to her had more to do with sort of the competitive aspect of the two musicians' friendships, and this is her quote: "Eric just wanted what George had," and I think that's very telling, especially considering that she later married the man. But we're getting ahead of ourselves.
Yeah.
Clapton would later say, you know, she belonged to this powerful man who seemed to have everything I wanted. You know, an amazing cars, an incredible career, and a beautiful wife. They were like Camelot, and I was like Lancelot, this outsider that enters the magical beetle kingdom and kind of breaks up the snake in the beetle garden of Eden, if you will. So, if you want to play, you know, amateur psychologist here, I mean, Patty Boyd is the living embodiment of Eric Clapton's ambitions, with the added bonus of being totally forbidden fruit. I mean, this is his best friend's wife.
Right.
So, you know, what's not to love? She's beautiful. By all accounts, she's kind and talented. I've never heard a bad word about her throughout this entire saga. So around 69 or so, the platonic friendship that was really just sort of based around, like, you know, thanking Patty for cooking great meals when he came over for dinner to hang out with George, and like saying that he liked her cool outfit because she was in fashion, like that was what he would later say was like kind of what their conversation was in the mid 60s. It started to get a little more serious, and he started to really pine for her, and he tries to take his mind off of her by getting engaged, by sort of a strange choice for a fiance, a daughter of a conservative government minister named Alice Ormsby Gore. And here's where the love triangle gets really messy. George wants to have an affair, allegedly, I should say, allegedly. This is my experience at People Magazine has taught me one thing. Always say allegedly.
Allegedly, okay.
George wants to have an affair with his wife Patty's sister Paula. And George asks Eric to run interference and hang out with Patty, basically distract her so that he can be free to run off with Paula.
Oh, man, he did it to himself. He shot himself in the foot.
Well, no, it gets even worse. Somehow, Eric winds up with Paula, despite his engagement, and he ends up having this like really, really tempestuous affair with Paula simply because she's Patty's sister, and she resembles Patty. It's just like, so again, you unpack the psychology of that for a moment. There's a lot happening there.
Some messed up stuff going on.
Right. Yeah. We'll give everyone a minute to like follow that.
Well, let's like talk about when these guys are first meeting. Beatles are at the height of popularity in the world, right? I mean, you're talking mid-60s. They are the thing. But I would think that Harrison is looking at Clapton as the artistic embodiment of what he probably wanted to be. And I don't think that Harrison was probably there yet as a guitar player. Like, in my opinion, he really just took jumps forward every year of the 60s as a player, and then continued to into the 70s. And I wonder about, like, from George Harrison's point of view, you know, having the success, but probably wanting to make something artistically important, in trying to model himself after, for years, I think that he tried to model himself after people like Chuck Berry until the Beatles became popular. And then who is he going to model himself after? And I think he was trying to model Clapton's playing with his style. And, you know, Harrison ended up having really his own unique style. But it's really a big, big deal when you look at the Beatles and that, okay, they're going to have any guests on a song. He chose his friend Clapton to take the guitar solo on a song that talks about guitar. Like, that could have been his standout moment. So, like you said, it's really a testament to their friendship and closeness and mutual admiration for one another. So you have all these things going, all these things are cooking. And then what turns, at what point do you think that it's like Clapton says, I'm going for it. I need, you know, I want to get together with it, even though it's my best friend's wife, let's do it. Do you think he internalized that at first in writing these songs and in Layla in particular, or do you think it manifested itself in reality first?
I think it was in reality first. And that, just to go back very quickly to something you said earlier, that's an incredible point you made about how, you're right, George really did envy Eric, not only for his artistry and sort of the band that he was in, he really envied his freedom. He was a free agent. I mean, he went from band to band. He was kind of a hired hand. George was pretty much from the moment that at least America became aware of the Beatles, George more or less wanted out. I mean, he found it confining for the vast majority of his experience. And I think you're right. He envied a lot about Eric, his freedom. I mean, he was this sort of hired hand gunslinger who sort of went right. where the wind took him and kind of moved from band to band. And, you know, he famously quit the Yardbirds because he thought, I think it was For Your Love, was like a total sellout poppy, you know, yeah. crap track.
Right.
Like, George, I'm sure would have loved to have done that.
No kidding. No kidding. That's true. That's a good point. Huh.
So that's a really great point you made about how there was the envy went both ways, but in this case. Specifically about Patty, Eric in the spring of 1970, he can't take it anymore. He's just, I mean, like, you know, like the song, he's been driven insane. He sends mm-hmm. Patty a letter marked express and urgent, and it says, according to his memoir at least, "What I want to know is if you still love your husband, or if you have another lover. If there is still a feeling in your heart for me, you must let me know. All my love, E." And and so she gets this letter at her home, and that evening the phone rings, and it's Eric, and he said, you know, "Did you get my letter?" And Patty, this was a total shock to her. And it was kind of, the call sort of ended in sort of embarrassment and confusion. And they started flirting, but at the time, she kind of saw it as a way to kind of get revenge on George, because at that point in time in early 1970, their relationship was kind of starting to wind down. He was kind of openly having affairs, and he was really more, according to her memoir at least, so focused on his studies of Eastern spirituality that he really wasn't giving her much attention as a husband. So I think she kind of used Eric, used is a strong word, but I think she appreciated his attention and kind of used it to try to like get attention from her husband. I think at this point, though, she didn't really consider it a serious, you know, "I'm going to leave my husband for this guy." I think it was just something that, you know, worked in her favor. But concurrently, around the same time, I think this was around actually December of 1969, Eric and George were actually sharing the stage together, touring with Delaney and Bonnie, American sort of blues act that were touring around Europe at the time. And George is basically slumming it. I mean, he's like an anonymous musician, like backing musician on the stage. I don't think he's on, you know, any poster or anything. He's not in the spotlight at all. He's like kind of slinking off on the edge of the stage by an amplifier or something. And other members of this group include Bobby Whitlock, Carl Radel, I think is how you say his name, and Jim Gordon, who would go on to be the Dominoes.
Yeah.
And great, incredible band. There's a great live album, I think, from the same period that you know, attests to this. Incredible album, incredible band. Not an incredibly happy musical partnership. Bobby Whitlock would recall that Delaney basically was like James Brown. He was like a really demanding band leader, and I think he called him like something of a cheapskate too. So there was dissent in their ranks, and some of the members left. I think some of the future Dominoes went off to join Joe Cocker's Mad Dogs and Englishmen tour with Leon Russell. Whitlock ends up leaving the tour, and in the spring of 1970, he goes to England to just stay with his buddy Clapton, and they're hanging out together, and they're just playing music, and they have the idea to start another band. They really, it's just sort of this free form thing, and they think about contacting Carl Radel and Jim Gordon. Actually, they were trying to get Jim Keltner, who's, you know, now this legendary session musician, but I think he was tied up with somebody else. So they knew that Jim Gordon was in England recording All Things Must Pass, George Harrison's first post-Beatles solo album. Mm. Yeah. And so, of course, you know, Eric's been invited to play on George, you know, his buddy George's first post-Beatles solo album. Hello, of course Eric's going to be there. So this band starts to sort of coalesce in the studio while they're working on All Things Must Pass. And you know, you have Eric, you have Jim Whitlock, you have Carl Radel, and you have Jim Gordon. And this is sort of really the beginning of the Dominoes. And just to sort of show you how enmeshed in the band's story Patty Boyd is, Eric got the band an apartment in London, which was, you know, for just for them to stay while they were in town, and also served as his, like, basically, like, crash pad to have his like secret meetings with Patty.
Man,
so it's yeah,
that's crazy.
Yeah, there was some, I don't know if double dealing is the right phrase, but yeah, there it's kind of all Patty's a big part of this. So,
well, let's look at just the song titles of a couple of these, the songs that she supposedly inspired from what I found. Something by the freaking Beatles, Something, one of the most popular songs they ever did. For You Blue, mm-hmm. on Let It Be, Clapton songs, Layla, Bell Bottom Blues, and Wonderful Tonight. Is there more? Is there been any romantic relationship or person rather that inspired more love songs in the history of rock music? I don't know of any.
I don't like, know. No, don't forget, like, I Need You by George on the Help album, which is also a gorgeous song. Like,
yeah.
She's the greatest muse in rock. I mean, she's the coolest. She's so great.
That's the best way to put it. Okay, so the story, the muse part. Do you know the story about where the title Layla came from and where that originated?
Yeah, that was... it was inspired by a love story that I think has its origins in the 7th century in Arabia. And it later formed the basis of a story by the Persian poet Nizami Gunjavi. And it was called mm-hmm. The Story of Layla and Majnun. And the story is about a moon princess who was married off by her father to a man she didn't love. And this resulted in her lover Majnun's, he goes insane with longing and desire for this woman that he couldn't have. And this strikes a deep chord with Eric. I mean, there's a line in the book, born of pain and longing, their song had the power to break the unhappiness of the world. I mean, to a lovesick wow. guitar hero, you know, right. that is completely, that hits him deep. I mean,
yeah.
Getting back to sort of like how ingrained in the band's story, in the Derek and the Dominoes story, Patty is, in his memoir, he's writing about their first gig in London in June of 1970. And his main memory is that after the show, he seeks out Dr. John, the sort of the jazz bayou pianist from New Orleans, mm-hmm. who was rumored to have ties to sort of voodoo powers. And he goes to Dr. John this night and basically says, can you use your voodoo powers to help me here? Can you give me...
No way.
Can you give me a love potion number 9? Was basically how he said it.
I've never heard that.
Oh, no. So he gives, Clapton a small box of woven straw that he is instructed to carry with him in his pocket, I think at all times, and he writes out these instructions of what to do for this spell that would basically make Patty fall in love with him. So a couple weeks go by.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, no, he's in it deep. I mean, he went, you know, before I, the whole line about Layla, about before I finally go insane, like Clapton, yeah. Clapton's there. He's desperate. I mean, and you know, for I'm thinking back to high school when I was like, you know,
yeah.
the nerdy music nerd, I'd hear Layla and just like the whole story of this really connected with me. I mean, that,
yeah.
You know, anybody who's been a victim, should I say, of unrequited love.
Victim of love.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that whole thing really hits a chord. So he's next time he sees Patty, it's at the after party for the premiere of the musical O Calcutta in London. And he goes over, he talks to Patty. George, kind of out of the corner of his eye, notices that he's picking up on some kind of energy over there, flirtation, whatever you want to call it. He goes over and kind of says, hey, you know, what's going on, you two? And Eric finally says to his face, hey, I have to tell you, man, I'm in love with your wife. And that was the moment. I think this was right before he goes to start recording Layla. He finally has it out with George
in a
fairly non-dramatic way. I guess George didn't respond, just turned to Patty and said, well, okay, you know, who are you going to go with tonight? Because, I mean, I think from what the people who knew George and Eric at the time said, that George kind of had figured it out, and his, I mean, not to be too crude, but his more or less his attitude was like, fine, you know,
yeah,
like
yeah.
go for it.
Right.
But she ends up rebuffing him. So he ends up writing this song and goes to Miami to Criteria Studios to record the album with Derek and the Dominoes with the mighty Tom Dowd incredible producer and engineer that Eric had worked with on when he played on Aretha Franklin's Lady Soul album. He played a solo on that, and Tom Dowd is great. Oh, yeah, I mean, he's worked on all those kind of like Fame Studios kind of swampy R&B stuff. I mean, he's a total legend. So they go down there and begin working on this album. And for a time, the first couple days, the sessions are pretty lackluster. And then Tom Dowd, probably his greatest contribution to the sessions, is that he gets Dwayne Allman into the mix.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really when things take off. And speaking of Mutual Admiration Society.
Right. Those two.
Oh, big time.
Man.
Clapton had, I think the reason that Tom Dowd made the connection is that Clapton made the call to Tom Dowd to say, you know, I want to book Criteria Studio for such and such a time. And he was literally on the phone with Clapton when he was in the studio with the Allman Brothers working on Idlewild South. And he hung up and basically said, you know, guess who that was? Eric Clapton. and Dwayne was like, oh my God, that he's the best. You know, I'd give anything to meet that guy. So when Clapton came, the Allman Brothers were playing in Miami during the session. So they all went to see the Allman Brothers show. And I guess Dwayne saw Clapton in the audience and froze from the stage. I mean, he was just like, oh man. Okay. Like, you know. But they ended up, great show, totally invigorated by seeing Clapton there. After the show, they go back to Criteria Studios, and they jam for supposedly 18 hours. That is the myth, right? Like, you know, no food. No, I mean, probably, I imagine cocaine might have played a role in that. But but Clapton later described Allman as the musical brother that I never had but wished I did. And I think that freed him for these sessions. I think that really, gave him a sparring partner, reinvigorated him, probably took his mind off of this depression of, you know, Patty and the unrequited love. But as you mentioned earlier, I mean, there's definitely a theme on this album. I mean, from the delicate declaration of I'm Yours to Bell Bottom Blues to even the covers, like Why Does Love Gotta Be So Sad and Freddie King's Have You Ever Loved a Woman? There's this overwhelming sense of longing.
Oh, Clapton
is this open wound, and he's a raw nerve. And they more or less record the album kind of sequentially, and one of the last songs they do is Layla, which Clapton had originally written as a ballad. Which, you know, I feel like that's a great blues tradition is when you're, I mean, Have You Ever Loved a Woman is a great example of that. This kind of slow, plodding, depressed, you know, I'm heartbroken type song. And apparently it was Dwayne Allman who picked up the tempo and sped up the song's riff, which was borrowed from an Albert King track called As the Years Go Passing By. And if you listen to it, I think it's about a minute into the song, you hear it. It's like do 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 do, and it's funny. I mean, it's like it's almost like proto sampling. It's like it's not a main riff of the song. It's a total like one musical phrase that I don't even think it's repeated. But it's note for note. That was it, seven notes, something like that. Listen to it. It's really crazy. I mean, back to where it was borrowed from, you know, all blues people borrow. So they recorded, I think it was six guitar parts. I think Eric did the rhythm, and then there were three tracks of Eric playing sort of harmony parts, guitar-many, if you will, and then one of Dwayne Allman playing bottleneck, and then a sixth track of Dwayne and Eric kind of locked together playing counter melodies. And that was the first half of the song. That was the you know, what do you do when you get lonely, the rock part. And then you get to the heavenly piano coda, which is, I mean, for my money, one of the most beautiful pieces of music in, you know, in rock.
I want to pause on that. Do you remember the first, like, I remember the first time I realized what was happening on that song.
It was
so many years ago, but I heard it. I was like, is this a different song? And then once you realize it's the same thing, it's like, holy cow, that's that was really intentional. And that's a really big deal. This is a gigantic song that they just took a massive turn. And it's so romantic in the melody and the mood of it, right?
When you think of it, like, from where he's coming from. Separate songs. I thought it was like a We Will Rock You, We Are the Champions kind of thing that, like, the DJs would just play back to back. And then I realized it was one song.
Yeah, me too.
I spent a lot of time as a,
yes,
you know, heartsick teenager or whatever, trying to figure out if, you know, if this song were a movie, and it is very cinematic, what that transition meant.
It is.
Did he get the girl and this is the happily ever after? Did he kill himself out of grief for not having her and this was the heavenly ascent? You know, I was always trying to figure out, and to this day, I don't know. I don't know if there really was a meaning other than it sounded good. But I remember thinking a lot about, you know, why that was added. And to the best of my knowledge, it was purely by chance. There's the famous story that the drummer, Jim Gordon, was basically using excess studio time that was marked for Derek and the Domino Sessions to try to work on his own solo album. And Eric came in and caught him. And he was playing this piano piece, and Eric basically said, "Oh man, that's great! Hey, tell you what, you can use the studio time that we don't use scot free for that," which fairly even trade.
For
but
that,
I hesitate to even say this part of the story because I don't want it to taint this beautiful piece of music. But I do want to give her credit. The credit for the song. Part of that the piano coda gets a little murky because in later years it came out that Jim Gordon effectively stole that piece of music from his girlfriend at the time, Rita Coolidge, which is apparently was abusive to her and she basically feared his temper and didn't speak up when he took the song. But there's a version of it that was recorded. The song's called Time, and she gave it to Booker T of Booker T and the MGs as an album cut for his 1973 album Chronicles. And it's a beautiful song. I mean, it's so weird to hear that, you know, really familiar reprise in a very different context. It's a great, funny juxtaposition. More about Jim Gordon later. I mean, he has a real,
He's got his own story. So I've never heard anybody talk about the meaning behind the instrumental in this song, and that's really interesting. So, like, what comes to mind for me is it doesn't feel happy. It doesn't feel sad, but it almost feels like, for me, like somebody, this is going to be a different decade, but like a Bruce Hornsby, where you're hearing it, and it's like a mixed, like a sad but not sad moment. I don't know. There's like a way, like a heartsick. Is what I kind of feel. It's like a romanticized, heartsick feeling is how I would probably, if I had to describe what I felt towards the end of that song. It's very wistful and, like you said, romantic. But, so this song comes out. Dwayne Allman. Let's talk one briefly on Dwayne Allman, because you have Eric Clapton, who is the guitar hero of the 60s, along with like Clapton and Townsend. You got these huge guys, but he is at the top. In the top realm of guitar players. I can't imagine the relief somebody like that would feel when you have a Dwayne Allman step up next to you, and then you're the guy writing the songs and playing the guitar, and for once you can step back and be like, oh, that guy, he can do what I'm doing and take it even further in some ways. I would think that that would have been the biggest push forward when you start recording these songs, and so he could focus on the guitar and focus on the singing and not have to be all things
so
to everyone. Like he had been in a lot of ways, you know?
When the first early reviews of Derek and the Dominoes, when they were playing shows around London before recording this, and even when the album came out, some of the early reviews, people were really reluctant to see Clapton move as being, if you're going to use the almost famous Stillwater dichotomy, move from being the guitarist with mystique to being the front man. They sort of liked having him be the guy who would just go off on these psychedelic guitar odysseys for 10 minutes. And that was, they kind of were like, why are you singing?
Yeah.
You know, why are you, this isn't really what you do. So and that was kind of, a lot of the reviews, both to the band itself and the album Layla, that was kind of a recurring theme, was this isn't really what he does. Like, where are the virtuosic, you know, crazy solos and stuff? I mean, obviously Layla has them, but it's not the same. It's not like, it's not like Crossroads or something like that. But that's, but you're totally right with, with Dwayne there. You're right. I think it probably did mentally free him to be more of this, he would later call Derek a character. He said, I was masking myself because otherwise it was just me, Eric Clapton, singing a song about being in love with my best friend's girl. You know, I mean, it was almost like when the Beatles were Sgt. Pepper. He was having this really thinly disguised.
Trying on another persona almost. Interesting. Okay, so this album's recorded, like you said, in September 1970 in Miami. They knock it out. It is just classic songs now looking back. But talk about the time frame. Just over a year later, Dwayne Allman dies in October 1971, which I would think would have been heartbreaking for Eric Clapton in particular. And I know that for the 70s, for him, it was a lot of drug use. And it seems like he went into a dark place, at least from the documentary that I've watched and read about him. Is that what you pick up from kind of what happened there and how he took that news?
I would say they press stop on the recording for Layla on the tape machine. Everything just started going south for Clapton in a big way. I mean, just days after they recorded Layla, his friend and kind of hero, Jimi Hendrix, died, and they've recorded a version of Little Wing on the album. That really distressed him in a big way. He finishes the song Layla. He goes back to England. He plays it for Patty. I think he invites her over to his apartment or his house or something. And according to, you know, the mythology around it, plays it for him and more or less says, I mean, she knows what it's about immediately. And she's kind of embarrassed. She's like, oh, great. Now this guy is going to like put this out there and everybody's going to know who it's about. And this is like really embarrassing. And I don't really have an avenue to respond. And I don't really have any say in this. And he supposedly said, according to one biography, are you going to leave George and go with me? Because if you don't, and he supposedly waved a bag of heroin at her and said, I'm just going to, this is my life now if you don't. And she said, and again, this sounds so, you know, Lifetime movie. Wow. And I, this is one version I've heard. And she said, you know, no, I can't. And he just said, well, I'm off. And he just totally withdrew for years into drug abuse in his home. I think something like 3 years, he barely did anything. He did heroin and made model airplanes. From my understanding, he barely touched a guitar. As you mentioned, Dwayne Allman was killed in a motorcycle accident, I think in October of 1971. Between him and Hendrix, just total double whammy.
Yep.
The band, Derek and the Dominoes, broke up when they tried to record a second album. It was just drugs, too much touring. Eric just wasn't psychologically there. I mean, at this point, he was wearing a little gold spoon around his neck to just for easy access to snort heroin round the clock. I mean, this is when he really graduated from being somebody who used to really dull his pain to being, you know, an addict. I mean, it was just really sad. It was something like 1,000 pounds a week, which is 10,000 pounds a day, which is something like $15,000 a week, rather. That was what his habit was costing him. Really, really rough time for Clapton and the other band members too. I mean, Carl Rattle died of heroin related kidney failure in 1980, and Jim Gordon famously. Yeah, Jim Gordon. I mean, just a word about Jim Gordon.
Listen on that.
He was part of the Wrecking Crew, the famous L.A.
I didn't realize that.
Yo, he studied under Hal Blaine. Like, he's on Pet Sounds. He's on, like, a lot of great. I think he's on.
I didn't catch that.
Check out his discography. It's nuts. He plays on, like, some Birds albums. He was a real key 60s L.A. session player before moving on to the kind of like, you know, Space Cowboys early 70s of Delaney and Bonnie and Derek and the Dominoes. He kept up his session work in the 70s. He's playing on, you can hear him on Ricky Don't Lose That Number by Steely Dan and Midnight at the Oasis by Maria Muldaur. But he was an undiagnosed schizophrenic, and he heard voices, and they convinced him that his mother was evil and that she had somehow been involved with the death of Karen Carpenter and, bizarrely, the comedian Paul Lynde, which I'm not really sure how he factored into it.
Random.
But yeah. Okay. And finally, in I think 1983, the voices in his head convinced him to murder his mother, I think, with a hammer, I believe. Really horrendous story. He's in, I think he's still, I mean, I'm pretty sure.
He's still alive. He's still in prison.
Yeah,
I think he's up. Like, wow.
It's really sad. I mean, so many people associated with this album really, you know, either didn't escape with their lives or just barely. And one of the people who did, thankfully, was Clapton. By 1974, he'd beaten his heroin addiction. His friend Pete Townsend famously threw a sort of welcome back concert for him at the Rainbow Theater in London, which is a great live album and concert film. Very tellingly, I think the only thing he did in the years when he was kind of in the wilderness was the concert for Bangladesh with George. George was the only one who got him to, like, you know, really do anything.
Something.
Yeah.
Huh.
But once he kicked his addiction, he again pursued Patty, who at this point was really getting tired of George's infidelities. I think the breaking point that I heard was that George had an affair with Ringo Starr's wife in their own home.
Man, I don't think I had heard that. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. It was not a happy relationship. There's the song So Sad on George's album Dark Horse in 1974, which is about his sort of, you know, unhappy personal life. And that was about the year 1974 that they separated and their divorce was finalized in 1977. And there's this myth, and I really want it to be true. The actor John Hurt claimed that when Eric was in the midst of basically stealing Patty away for good, he went to George Harrison's home and they had a guitar duel over Patty. Yeah. Which, I mean...
I hope that's true. I hope so.
Yeah, Clapton later said, like, no, we played guitar. It wasn't a duel for, like, this woman. That's ridiculous. But I don't know. A part of me really wants to
It's a funny
it.
Visual.
Right, it's so great. Yeah, I mean, it's so good.
And then they finally got married, right? Clapton and Patty eventually get married in 1979 for a short time, right? For 10 years.
Yeah, and it was, like, kind of this funny... It almost seems like some kind of weird French farce. I mean, I guess, like, George, Eric, and Patty were at the dinner table, and George said something like, well, suppose I better divorce her. You know, like, speaking about her like she's not there. And George and Eric was like, well, if you do divorce her, I guess that means I got to marry her. which is, like, so cringy.
So weird, yeah.
And then they go to the wedding. George is there. He calls himself the husband-in-law, which is awesome. Which is a hilarious thing. He jams with Ringo and Paul. It was the closest to a Beatle reunion I think that there had been at their wedding reception. And they were together 10 years. It was not a happy ending. You know, Patty again would sort of later theorize that the chase was better than actually, you know, being in a real relationship for Clapton, and they officially got divorced, I think, in 1988. And he wrote the song off of Journeyman, Old Love for Her, which was about, you know, love getting old and fading. And he thought that she would be kind of flattered by this kind of, I don't know, poignant farewell. But she wrote, either in her memoir or in an interview since, like, no, I was horrified. You know, the end of a relationship is sad enough, but then you have Eric writing about it. And
put a soundtrack to it.
Right, and I can't answer him back. That was the phrase that she said. She said, I couldn't answer him back, which is kind of the flip side, I think, that doesn't really get pointed out enough.
Yeah, that is interesting. Same with Layla too, where she couldn't say anything back. He just announced it, and again, he did it to her, and she can't, you know,
Right.
Steve Kerr's side.
I mean, I know it's been mythologized, romanticized for so many years, but I mean, being the muse for these guys kind of sounds like hell. Especially for these guys in particular.
Yeah, and they really, it seems like it was much more than just love. There was a competition factor. Well, talk. Can you talk for the last question about how did these guys' friendship end? Did they stay friends through the 80s to the end of their into George's life, or was there a rift, or how did they end?
Oh yeah, they were, you know, probably my favorite bromance in rock and roll. You know, I mean, you got I think they toured Japan together in 1991, and George didn't, you know, tour much. I don't know offhand, but I think after the Dark Horse tour in 1974, that those dates in 91 might have been his only tour dates. I forget, but Eric was right along with him, and I have a funny feeling that was a big, you know, I'm not doing this unless I got my friend with me kind of way to make it worth it to him. And they played on all sorts of tracks for each other all throughout the 90s. And then after George's death in November of 2001, Eric had the idea to stage the concert for George the following year.
Yeah, that's right. That was a big deal.
Gutting. I mean, I've watched that and just had tears in my eyes. I mean, it has been really, really powerful. I mean, the performances are great, first of all, but then you see him up there. I think my favorite moment is when Paul McCartney and Eric, split up something, and the first half Paul does it, which, you know, by virtue of being a Beatle, he gets you know rights to doing some of it, but then you have Eric singing the other half of something, the second verse and chorus about the woman that Eric wrote it for, that he was also married to and loved at that same time that he wrote
that's
it in
wild.
1969, thinking like, what is going through this guy's head? When he sang that, whenever I watch that performance, which is, you know, incredibly touching and moving and great, I just wonder what the hell is going through that guy's head when he's singing these words. Like,
no kidding. Well, man, Jordan, I appreciate you coming on to talk about this classic song. And gosh, I know you and I both, like I said earlier, love the stories behind songs. And this has got to be one of the most jam-packed story songs for me in rock music. So I appreciate you bringing your expertise and thoughts on the song. This is totally great, and appreciate you coming on the show today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. It's been a blast.
Thank you for listening to the Songs of Note podcast. Be sure and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. See you next time.